You're listening to the Body Pros CME and CE podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. This is part of a podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body Pro. I'm here today with Dr. Kathy Anastas, Executive Co-Director of WEAX, a community-based organization providing HIV care in Rwanda. She's also Professor of Medicine, Epidemiology, and Population Health at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. She's going to provide an update from CROI 2008 on some of the more important presentations on HIV prevention, treatment, and care for women.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kathy Anastas, and we're going to talk today about new findings at CROI 2008 that are specific to HIV-infected women. We will first talk about HIV disease progression and response to therapy. We'll talk about some very specific issues that are always of concern to HIV-infected women, specifically reproductive cycling. And we will talk about the growing science regarding how to prevent HIV transmission to women. So let's start first with a study that assesses sex differences in viral load, specifically at different CD4 levels. So this follows up on a previous fund of knowledge that we have had, but which at the time it was first elucidated was so surprising that many people thought it was not true and the researchers must be wrong. And that is that viral loads in women are clearly lower than viral loads in men. And this study from CROI 2008 extends our previous fund of knowledge in that it includes women from many parts of the world, and it includes women at lower CD4 cell counts, but within a single study than we've ever been able to study before. So this was a sample taken from 8 resource-limited countries and the United States, people enrolled in a randomized clinical trial. There were 831 men and 740 women. Everybody who was enrolled had a CD4 cell count of less than 300. And what they found was that there was an almost perfect linear relationship between a lower CD4 cell count and a smaller difference between women and men in their viral loads, that is, their HIV-1 RNA levels. So that the people who had CD4 cell counts of up to 300, there was approximately a 0.2 log difference, and people with a CD4 cell count down below 50, the difference was less than 0.1 logs. This is in keeping with all previous data, which has indicated that there's a greater difference between women and men at higher CD4 cell counts, meaning women have much lower HIV RNAs at the higher CD4 cell counts. But we have never before been able to see this sort of direct linear relationship. So let's next talk about what happens to women and men on therapy, meaning when people are treated, is there a sex difference in the response? One group presented a study that addressed this. There were 617 women and almost 2,000 men in this study. And what they were looking at was whether there were any differences by race and sex in response to treatment. And the outcomes that were measured were the ability to get a viral load below 400. As is almost always the case, there were differences between the women and men at study entry. The women were more likely to be Black, were younger, had higher CD4 cell counts at entry. In general, that's always true, both because women access care earlier, but also because, in general, women without HIV infection have a higher CD4 cell count than men. Women were less likely to have had an AIDS diagnosis and were less likely to have had heart during the course of their care. And the bottom line of these findings were that if you did an unadjusted analysis, both people who were Black and women were less likely to have a good virologic response. However, when you adjusted for a variety of differences, but especially receiving heart, the difference by race disappeared, but the difference by sex became more pronounced. so that after adjusted analyses, women were 50% more likely to die compared to the men, whereas people of color had a similar risk of death compared to the men. However, I want to contrast that with another study, this study coming from the military cohort in the United States. The importance of the military cohort in the United States is that many of the socio-demographic differences you find between women and men or between people of color and whites in the United States are almost obviated in the military. Everyone has a similar income. Everyone, at least until recently, had graduated from high school. Everyone has access to care. The providers of care are the same for both groups of people. And what was found in this study from the military was that there was no difference between women and men in terms of achieving a good virologic response on HEART. But there was a difference by race. Specifically, the people of color were only half as likely to achieve an undetectable viral load. Half as likely. That is really a huge difference. And it was highly statistically significant with a p-value of less than 0.001. So again, as I alluded to earlier, we find that we have contradictory results. Do women respond better, or do women respond the same, or do women respond less well to treatment? And in fact, you could say the same thing about differences by race. And the short answer is currently, we don't have enough information to know. So we had a couple other studies from CROI that added some information to our knowledge, sometimes fairly important information. The first is a study of women in Rwanda, looking at nutritional status prior to treatment and whether that predicted a good or poor response to antiretroviral therapy. So this was a study that was restricted to HIV-positive women, 457 women who had initiated antiretroviral therapy. Women were seen every 6 months, and there were multiple measures taken every 6 months, but included both some laboratory testing and measures of body composition. And what the authors found was that in no measure of nutrition was there any predictive value of either the CD4 response to antiretroviral therapy or the virologic response. So specifically, the serum albumin, the hemoglobin, total body fat, or fat-free mass did not predict the response to therapy. This is an encouraging finding because in many parts of the world now, poor nutritional status is common among HIV-infected people initiating therapy. And this study suggests that mild pretreatment malnutrition does not impair the response to HEART. We also have a study from France that looks at the causes of death in HIV-infected women and how they've changed since 2000. It actually looks at the causes of death in HIV-infected men also. It's a fairly large study. There were 1,042 people included in 2005 compared to 964 people included in the year 2000. Approximately 22 to 24% of these participants were women, and the information is gained first from public health death data, followed by chart abstraction in France. And the remarkable finding in this study is that in 2000, women and men were equally likely to die from AIDS. But by 2005, women were much more likely to die from AIDS and much less likely to die from other causes. Now, in uncontrolled comparisons that we have from other studies, for example, the Women's Interagency HIV study, we see that women remain very likely to die from AIDS right through to the present. So the causes of death for women and Ys are more than 50% of the women are dying from AIDS. This is in contrast to other studies of men in general, which tend to show that AIDS is no longer the leading cause of death. So what accounts for that? Certainly, neither of these studies tells us the answer for why that is happening. But we have to consider that there's truly a biologic sex difference, not just a difference in access to care. Now, there's been some indication in the past, especially from the Women's Interagency HIV study, that the NRTIs may act somewhat differently in women than they do in men. Specifically, that there seems to be more NRTI-specific toxicity in women than is generally described in studies of men, although there are very few studies that have direct comparisons. So the Women's Interagency HIV study provided information at CROI 2008 regarding the development of insulin resistance among women. The WISE, Women's Interagency HIV study, in general, has enrolled a little over 3,700 women, of whom almost 1,000 were HIV negative, and therefore provide a good comparison group over time. This particular study included 2,218 women who contributed a total of 11,000 visits, in which they had a fasting glucose and insulin measured. And what the study found using the HOMA index as the measure of insulin resistance was that women reporting the use of any kind of HART since their prior visit were more likely to have insulin resistance. This was true whether the HART had a PI included or did not have a PI included. In addition, the usual things that affect insulin resistance were found to be predictive, that is, hepatitis C, a family history of diabetes, increasing age, increasing body mass index, and having gone through menopause. Now, taking a closer look at the components of HART, it was found that it's really the NRTIs that were predicting the insulin resistance, and the protease inhibitor use and the NNRTI use was not associated with insulin resistance. Then in further analysis, the authors looked at which components of the NRTIs were contributing, and it was found to be almost entirely stavudine, or D4T. So the authors concluded that although any use of HART was associated with a higher likelihood of insulin resistance, that the cumulative exposure to the NRTIs, especially stavudine, but not the PIs or the NNRTIs, were independently associated with higher insulin resistance, suggesting that we need further study to understand this better. Now, another study comparing women and men in ACTG trial 5142 also had findings suggesting there may be some NRTI effects in women that may be different from those in men. Specifically, this was a study of 753 people, of whom 20%, 151 were women, enrolled in a randomized clinical trial whose primary purpose was to compare three kinds of antiretroviral treatment in terms of efficacy, which has previously been reported. They compared efavirenz plus two NRTIs to lopinavir-ritonavir plus two NRTIs to a third regimen which had no NRTIs and was just efavirenz and lopinavir-ritonavir. And the findings specifically relating to sex differences were that virologic failure was associated with female sex. It was also associated with younger age, a lower CD4, and with black race. The sex differences were predominantly by regimen, so the risk of virologic failure was lower for women in the NRTI sparing arm, and there was no difference in the other arms. Similarly, the risk of toxicity was lower for women in the NRTI sparing arm. So therefore, the women had a longer time to virologic failure and a longer time to treatment-limiting toxicity with the NRTI sparing arm. This suggests, similar to the previous study from WISE, that the NRTIs may have different effects in women and men, and the frequently shown differences in toxicity that we see with HART between women and men may in fact mostly be driven by the NRTIs. And further study is needed for us to be able to understand this fully. So let me mention two studies that are not easily categorized, but which generally have great interest to HIV-infected women. The first is a study that looks at some of the predictors of HIV shedding in women's genital tract, meaning what is it that creates higher viral loads in women's genital tracts. This study really specifically was looking at whether immune activation systemically, not locally in the genital tract, but systemically throughout the body, was associated with higher viral loads in the genital tract. All studies in the past have indicated that the single strongest predictor of HIV viral load in the genital tract is the systemic HIV viral load, the viral load in the plasma. And it had really not previously been studied, what does systemic immune activation do? So systemic immune activation in this study was measured by looking at specific kinds of CD8 cells, whether they were DR positive or DR4 positive. This was a study of 225 HIV-infected wise women who had paired plasma and cervicovaginal lavage, or CVL, specimens available. And what they found was that systemic immune activation is significantly associated with viral load in the genital tract, and a lack of systemic immune activation, which is measured in a different way, was protective. We had in the past thought that it was mostly the local, meaning just compartmentalized in the genital tract, immune activation, which could be driving the genital viral load. This suggests that, in fact, the pathophysiologic mechanism might actually be systemic immune activation, and therefore this needs to be studied further. Another question that HIV-infected women frequently have, and in fact which the women and the wise have repeatedly asked for data regarding, is whether or not there is early menopause or early ovarian deficiency in HIV-infected women compared to uninfected women. And one would think this is easy to study, but it's not, in part because the ability to study menopause is an evolving field. And only really in the last 10 years have we had research methodology that allows us to start addressing this question. There was one study of premature ovarian deficiency in HIV-infected women, which included 78 HIV-infected women. They looked at four markers of ovarian function: follicle-stimulating hormone, inhibin B, anti-Mullerian hormone, also called Mullerian-inhibiting substance, or MIS, and they also did ultrasounds of the ovary and looked at the antral follicular count, and then did a descriptive analysis according to age. What they found was that in 85% of the women, at least one marker was abnormal, and there was no effect of treatment status, women's treatment status, on these ovarian markers. Now, this does not have a comparator group of HIV-negative women. However, any historical comparator of women in this age group, and the mean age was 34 years, would not find that 85% of women had at least one abnormal marker. So this essentially should be looked at as preliminary data suggesting that better controlled studies should be performed using these sort of new and multiple markers of ovarian function. Of note, there have been other studies of, not of ovarian function in HIV-infected women, but of clinically diagnosed menopause. And clinically diagnosed menopause almost always means the woman tells us, the provider, whether or not she's gone through menopause, and has not found a difference actually between the HIV-positive and the HIV-negative women. This study, however, has more sensitive measures and therefore should be expanded. So now let's talk about prevention of HIV transmission to women. We're going to start with a somewhat encouraging observational study, but then we're going to move into the clinical trials. And in this area, as in the vaccine trials, the results have been very disappointing in terms of the ability to actually prevent HIV transmission to people. So we'll start with a look at a normal, healthy vagina, which is really defined in great part by the presence of lactobacilli, which are hydrogen peroxide-producing bacteria present in women's vaginas in greater or lesser degree, and which for many years, or many decades even, have been known to promote genital health in women, or vaginal health in particular. I mean, for example, back in the 60s or 70s, we learned that the presence of lactobacilli would prevent yeast infections in women or make them less likely. So this study that was presented at CROI 2008 looked at 57 women who were seen multiple times and assessed the presence of lactobacilli as well as the presence of the bacteria that cause bacterial vaginosis. And they looked at the HIV-1 RNA levels, meaning the viral load in the vagina. And what they found was that the presence of lactobacilli was associated with a 0.5 log lower viral load, whereas the presence of bacterial vaginosis was associated with a 0.3 log higher viral load in the vagina. Now, that is on cross-sectional study. Now, longitudinally, they followed women over time and found that if a woman acquired more lactobacilli, had a higher level of lactobacilli over time, that was associated with a decreasing viral load. In fact, it decreased by 0.7 log, which is actually a huge decrease, especially in the vagina, which tends to have low viral loads to begin with. In addition, if the woman had lactobacilli but then lost them over time, there was a 0.5 log increase in the vaginal viral load. There was no effect of trichomonas or yeast infections or their change over time on the vaginal viral load. And the author's sort of bottom line was that vaginal health decreases the HIV viral load. Let me just say a word about why we would be studying this in the first place. The reason to study it is that these local factors in the vagina have been shown to be associated actually with HIV acquisition or HIV transmission, so that the presence of bacterial vaginosis, because it's a very common infection, if it increases transmissibility, it could have a very large population-based effect. So that is why this has been studied. So could we use this information to promote changes in women's vaginal health? And specifically, what you'd want to do is get rid of the bacterial vaginosis bacteria and increase the lactobacilli. It's not entirely straightforward how to do that. In theory, you can treat BV, bacterial vaginosis, which we do when we diagnose it and find it. But how do you get more lactobacilli into the vagina? In the past, I mean the distant past, like 30 years ago, there was much discussion among women about whether putting yogurt with live culture, it has to be live culture yogurt, putting it vaginally to increase vaginal health. So that has not actually been studied, but there was discussion of it at the meetings. Now, for somewhat discouraging news, let's talk about the intervention trials that have been done to assess whether certain kinds of interventions can prevent transmission to women. Actually, transmission in the other direction also, but specifically we're talking about the outcomes in women here. So there were two studies presented, actually two different speakers presented from the RAKAI study, which is a trial of male circumcision. The first speaker addressed whether circumcision in men would have any favorable outcomes in the female partners. So in this study, there were 3,516 men enrolled who were both HIV negative and HSV negative, meaning herpes simplex virus type 2, genital herpes infection negative. Of those, approximately half had immediate circumcision, and the rest had delayed circumcision, meaning 24 months later they would become circumcised. There was 24 months of follow-up with 80% retention. Now, one of the outcomes that was studied in men was whether this circumcision would prevent acquiring genital herpes infection, which it did. There was a 25% decrease in genital herpes infections in the men, and it was a greater effect, a 50% decrease, in men who were high risk, which basically meant inconsistent condom use. However, the women partners were also studied. In fact, the women partners here were defined as the wives of these men. So there were, among these 3,500 men, there were 1,608 wives, of whom 825 were married to men in the immediately circumcised group and 783 to men in the delayed circumcised group. There were 12 months of follow-up with 95% retention. And the outcomes that were looked at in women were vaginal symptoms and vaginal infections. There was no difference in vaginal symptoms, no difference at all, according to whether the man had been circumcised or not. There was a difference in diagnosed genital ulcer disease in the women who were in couples where the man had been circumcised, and a approximately 50% decrease in the incidence of trichomonas. Not much difference in bacterial vaginosis in general, but in severe bacterial vaginosis, there was a 70% decrease. So male circumcision was associated with decreases in genital ulcer disease, severe bacterial vaginosis, and trichomonas in the female partner. This same trial of circumcision in men, there was a second presentation which looked at the HIV-positive men who had been enrolled. So that previously we described what had happened with HIV-negative men. So this is HIV-positive men, and it looked at the effects in the men themselves and in the women partners. There were 992 HIV-positive men enrolled, and among them, there were 94 women partners of the men who got circumcised and 71 women partners of the men who did not get circumcised. And here were the results. There was no difference at all in genital infections among the women. There was also no difference at all in HIV transmission to the women from their male partners, with one exception. And that exception is that among couples who had sex early, meaning prior to wound healing, there was an enhanced transmission to the women, so that the transmission among couples who had early sex was 27% versus 9.5% in the couples who did not have early sex, which was essentially the same as the transmission rate in the uncircumcised men. So as you know, circumcision protects men from HIV acquisition, but it does not seem to be the case that circumcising HIV-infected men confers any protection to their female partner. And if the men are recently circumcised and there is sex prior to wound healing, that actually enhances transmission to the female partner. So another intervention that has been studied in clinical trials to prevent HIV acquisition or HIV transmission is to suppress herpes simplex genital episodes in people who are already herpes simplex infected. Now, why would we think this would work? We would think this would work because it is clearly known that people who have herpes simplex are more likely to have HIV infection or maybe even to acquire HIV infection. So the thinking was that if we could prevent the ulcerations from herpes simplex, then we could prevent the HIV transmission. So in this study, there were 3,277 people randomized to either have their herpes simplex suppressed or not suppressed. There were two groups of people included. One was women from Southern Africa who represented about half of the population, and the other is men who had sex with men from either Peru or the United States. They were randomized to receive oral acyclovir or not to receive it. The findings were this. There was clearly a decrease in herpes simplex episodes and ulcerations, but there was no difference in HIV acquisition, none at all, which was very disappointing. And the question is, why is that? And the short answer is, we don't know. There was some speculation that perhaps the association between herpes and HIV is that they are acquired simultaneously. And therefore, once somebody has HSV, suppressing it will not prevent the HIV transmission because it would have already occurred by then. However, it was very clear that it didn't work and that therefore suppressing herpes in people will not help them avoid HIV transmission. There was what we might want to call preclinical information presented regarding the new drug, Maraviroc. So as you know, Maraviroc is a CCR5 antagonist. It's a relatively new drug. It works by inhibiting cellular entry using the R5 receptor. Now, almost all HIV transmission occurs through the R5 receptor. meaning people who are already infected can be utilizing either R5 or X4. But at the time of infection, it almost all occurs through the R5 receptor. This study looked at the use of maraviroc in HIV-negative women and looked at the drug levels and other pharmacokinetic parameters in the genital tract. They studied 12 women, of whom 33% were African American. This is a U.S.-based study. And they found very interesting results that basically the drug levels in the genital tract, and what they were looking at was undiluted cervical vaginal fluids, was 11-fold higher than the drug level in the plasma. Now, the drug level in the plasma is, you know, an inhibitory dose, so it's high enough to prevent viral replication. The implications of having a log higher drug level in the genital tract for a drug that specifically blocks the CCR5 receptor, where all transmission must occur utilizing the CCR5 receptor, does give us some real hope that this could be a very effective preventive measure in HIV-negative women. Now, this study, clearly, this was done by taking the drug by mouth. And the way to deliver the drug for preventive therapy can either be to deliver it orally or to deliver it locally. And this study does not address the use of the drug locally. It did, however, have one additional piece of information that was very interesting, which is they measured how much protein binding there was for this drug in the genital tract. Now, in the plasma, for almost all drugs, there's a huge amount of protein binding, like up to 90%, and it is only the unbound portion of the drug that can work. So for maraviroc, in these same women, they looked at the blood plasma protein binding, which was 76%, in keeping with most drugs, but the local genital tract protein binding was only 7.6%. So suggesting that not only is the drug there in much higher concentrations, it's also much more available, which may, again, increase its ability to prevent transmission. So let me finish up by presenting not primary data, but information that was presented at a symposium regarding prevention of HIV transmission in women. First, Elizabeth Stringer gave a summary talk about the effect of hormonal contraception on HIV, HIV acquisition, HIV disease transmission, and HIV shedding in the genital tract. This has been a very controversial area for quite a while, and it's an enormously important area because preventing pregnancy for women everywhere, but especially in the developing world, is critical to women's health and well-being and the health and well-being of their children. And it is mostly done through hormonal means. So if there were effects of hormones on HIV acquisition or disease progression or shedding, these could have enormous population-based implications, as well as really implications for the individual woman's health. So first, acquisition. The most recent study on this was published in 2007. It was a large study of more than 6,000 women. There was a fairly low seroconversion rate of 2.8 per 100 person years. And there was no influence of Depo Provera or oral contraceptives on HIV acquisition. Specifically, the odds ratios of HIV acquisition were 0.9 for Depo, 1.0 for oral contraceptives, which clearly was not statistically significant. However, prior studies have indicated that there may be some effect. So there was a study in the journal AIDS in 2004, which studied 1,272 women and demonstrated that with hormonal contraception, there was 1.8-fold increased likelihood of HIV acquisition if it was Depo Provera, 1.5-fold higher likelihood if it was oral contraceptives, and 1.6-fold more likely if it was Norplant. The transmission rate in this study was higher, fourfold almost. It was 8.5 per 100 person years. It's really this study that in the past has raised the concern. Now, Dr. Stringer also showed a summary slide of all the published studies in the past, most of which show no effect. that there is neither an increased nor a decreased transmission rate if the woman is using a hormonal contraceptive. So let's next address the influence of hormones on disease progression. Again, the data is contradictory almost, right? So there's the Mombasa cohort, which is a seroconversion study, looked at the viral load set point in women who were taking hormonal contraception and found that it was 0.33 logs higher in the hormonal contraception users. Now, 0.33 logs is a twofold. It's doubled. It's a doubled viral load set point. And a 0.33 log difference does predict, in general, in most populations, predicts a faster disease progression. In addition, those same authors found that women who were taking hormonal contraception had multiple viral variants, were basically fourfold more likely to have multiple viral variants at the time of transmission, which was also associated with more rapid CD4 decline. And then there is a third study, a study from Zambia, in which women were randomized to receive either an IUD or hormonal contraception. Of note, the women with an IUD had more effective contraception, with the women on hormonal contraception have a 2.2-fold higher likelihood of becoming pregnant during the study. The women on hormones were more likely to have a CD4 decline to less than 200 cells and were more likely to have disease progression in toto measured as CD4 decline or death. And then in a time-varying analysis, meaning where they looked at whether the woman remained on hormonal contraception, they found that really only the Depo Provera was associated with a greater likelihood of progression, defined again as death or CD4 decline, and it was about a 50% more likely decline. Again, there was a summary slide shown of multiple, all the studies that have addressed this, and the findings are completely inconclusive, meaning some studies show an effect and some studies show no effect. And then finally, Dr. Stringer addressed HIV shedding. And the short answer is there's probably an effect, but again, we really don't know. All of this suggests that we need better research in this area, which is now occurring, but for many years was not occurring. So let's now just talk about two more presentations that addressed the underlying scientific paradigms that we should consider in looking at prevention in women. In the first, Dr. Rupert Call really discussed why we would think we could make interventions that could have an effect, that could decrease transmission. So what are the key concepts in transmission? One is, how much virus is there? What are the cells that are present, the susceptible cells that are present? So notice, how much virus does the transmitter have? How much susceptibility is there in the person who is uninfected? And what are the co-infections in each of the two parties? 90% of the transmission of HIV infection comes from only 20% of the HIV-infected people. And the factors that influence that are the viral load. There is something called the semen enhancer for viral infectivity, which is not real well defined. There are co-infections and there are host genetics. That's in the transmitter. In the susceptible person, there's how many susceptible cells are around, what are the other inflammatory mediators that are present, and again, host genetics, which we think plays a large role, but we have not defined it very well. So all of this would suggest that preventing sexually transmitted infections should prevent HIV transmission. But in fact, as you've seen from some of the data I presented earlier, mostly this doesn't seem to be true. So treating herpes simplex does not prevent HIV acquisition, and Dr. Call presented data on bacterial vaginosis, which again seemed not to have an impact on HIV transmission. And he had two bottom lines in this. One is, we need further study. And the second is, condoms remain the single most effective way to prevent HIV transmission and should continue to be promoted aggressively. Then finally, let's just talk a little bit about the local environment in the female genital tract and why we have not succeeded in our microbicide efforts to prevent transmission to women. Now, this is information that was presented by Dr. Betsy Harold's group, and really it goes back to the basic science of why something would work or not work. So I think you all know the story of Nanoxanil 9, that because it kills HIV in vitro, it was expected that this would be a very effective way to prevent HIV transmission to women. And in fact, what happened in clinical trials was that it enhanced HIV transmission to women and really significantly enhanced it. And there was a lot of speculation about why this was true, but it's only recently that we've found information that tells us why this is true. So there's two major factors here. One is that the epithelium provides a natural barrier against infection, and there are things that can disrupt that barrier, which doesn't mean in the presence of inflammation. It means it's a much more direct effect of changing what the barrier is. The second is there are small micropeptides in the vagina that protect us from being infected from a variety of pathogens, including viruses. So it turns out that Nanoxanil 9 both disrupts the epithelial barrier by breaking up what's called the tight junctions between the cells, and it also sort of kills off the micropeptides that are protecting us. So this group has found this to be true both for Nanoxanil 9 and for cellulose sulfate. Cellulose sulfate is the second microbicide that went into clinical trials and was also found to enhance transmission, and therefore the studies were stopped early. Now, there is some good news here, which is that there are other microbicides coming along, specifically something called Pro 2000 and also tenofovir, and maybe we should consider maraviroc, which has not been studied yet, that are not inflammatory, do not activate the inflammatory pathways, and therefore the Pro 2000 and tenofovir are not likely to increase HIV replication or recruit in new cells. Going back to what Dr. Call mentioned, that you have to have susceptible cells there, whereas cellulose sulfate and Nanoxanil 9 do recruit in new cells and increase HIV replication. So basically, Dr. Harold's group is suggesting that the safety evaluation of anything that's going to be considered as a microbicide needs to be evaluated prior to going into clinical trials in women. And there are ways to evaluate it specifically. There is a mouse model. And remember, safety includes not getting HIV. You don't want to be giving people something to prevent HIV when it's actually enhancing HIV transmission. So our understanding of the basic science explains why we have not succeeded with Nanoxanil 9 and cellulose sulfate, and importantly, gives us some hope about the new substances that we'll be able to test in the near future, and also, importantly, gives us a mechanism to assess safety prior to using these compounds in women who are at risk for HIV infection. So in summary, we've reviewed data that looks at disease progression in women, response to therapy, some basic pathophysiology, and how to prevent HIV transmission in women. We have way more information than we've ever had in the past, but I think you can see we still don't have enough. There need to be more studies that look at differences between women and men and by ancestral history and for response to therapy, that look at some really specific issues that are of concern to women, for example, reproductive hormones in HIV-infected women, and equally importantly, that assess how we can prevent HIV transmission to women who continue to be at higher risk than men for acquiring HIV.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been part of a CME and CE podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, as well as additional coverage of CROI 2008, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.